all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlove.
Are you serious? Have I really been sitting here muted this whole time?
You have been.
Where's your microphone? Get up there and say, hey, dummy. Hey, somebody's got a case of the Fridays over here.
Did you just call me dummy?
for letting me be a dummy? Yeah, we're in this one together now, pal. Like it or not.
We're breaking here. Up.
That's okay. Fine. We're both putting our mute buttons on.
Fine.
Here we are. Good morning. Nice to have you here. It's a beautiful Friday morning. It's a cold Friday, but thank you, Mary, for the greeting on Facebook. Good morning from Wanakee. Nice to have you along. She also noticed on Facebook, no audio.
Yeah, Mary, because, I know.
Yeah, we know. So here we go. Off to a good, robust start today. So let me start with a question. Remember Tim Michaels? Because we're going to get that again this year. You know, rich guy from the coast coming to Wisconsin to run for office because he'd been here previously. That's going to happen with the Senate race this year, apparently. Not with Tim Michaels, but with somebody from the other coast who also has connections to Wisconsin, but has spent a lot of time out of the state and still wants to run for Senate. So we'll talk about Eric Hovde wanting to run for Senate against Tammy Baldwin coming up today. But first, if folks watching the video, if you can go, hey, something looks a little bit off. Yes, somebody was messing around with our video buttons over here, Greg Bach. And so we're trying to, no, not you.
Oh, no, that was a no, very
somebody,
accusatory Greg
That Bach. Was my inviting you into the conversation. just like remember yesterday, somebody was messing with your board down there in Waukesha.
Yeah. Futzing. You're futzing.
You know how fun that is when that happens. And so we're a little discombobulated, as they say. But anyway, here we are. So we're going to be talking about the Eric Hovde potential announcement running against Tammy Baldwin. Mm-hmm. We'll talk to Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kip Akil about some big national headlines. There's also some breaking news internationally that I'm going to be talking about in a minute, just because it does have connections to one of our covey of quislings here in this country, Ron Johnson. We'll also be talking to Mark Jacob, who will review recent media activity like Tucker Carlson's Moscow visit / love letter. And Dan Schumacher will talk to us about sports coming up for this weekend. But it is cold up here. Not down by you, apparently, right?
Not really. It's like, it's not free. It's not like what you guys are getting up there.
No, it's 21 in Waukesha, 23 in Madison. It's 12 up here in Chippewa Falls. Hayward is at 7. Park Falls is at 5 below zero right now. It's 12 in Wausau, 12 in Green Bay, 15 in Wisconsin Rapids. La Crosse is at 21. Oshkosh is at 20. So there's a wide variation in temperatures here, and it might be butt cold, as in clear butt cold, up by you. So bundle up appropriately when the kids are heading out to the bus stop for one more day before we get a getaway. And somebody's got more than one day off coming up, so he might be a little squirrely this morning. But somehow your host will manage to push on through, and Greg will enjoy a week of peace and quiet here with Chad Holmes filling in Monday and Tuesday, Todd Alba Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But it's always nice to continue to have live radio shows. Live radio. Ain't nothing like it, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's tell you what's in the newsletter that you can get over at upnorthnewswi.com. You can enjoy the 3-day President's Day weekend with a quick getaway up north with some things to do around the Eau Claire and La Crosse areas. There's a story in the newsletter about unique workouts around Wisconsin. Greg, tell me if any of these unique Wisconsin workouts might appeal to you. At the Pettit Ice Center in Milwaukee, there are classes in speed skating, figure skating, and hockey skills. There are places all over the state to learn about curling, and there are places in Wisconsin where you can get a strength and cardio workout using a pole.
I'll go for the third one.
Pole dancing for cardio and strength, please. Yep. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a fitness routine, okay? Yes. There's nothing dirty about it. It's classy. It's classy exercise.
Yeah.
And you can learn all about that in the newsletter. Sign up for it over at upnorthnewswi.com. Over on our website, Democratic lawmakers are proposing a new gun safety measure designed to prevent mass shootings at colleges and universities. We'll hear from the bill's authors in just over a week, but you can read about their proposal online right now. And let's see, on Tuesday, we visited with Beth Haskovec from the state's Rural Thrive Wisconsin program. On our website, you can read more about some of the latest projects getting professional assistance to expand affordable housing, small business development, and more in Wisconsin's rural hometowns. So read all about that at upnorthnewswi.com. And one more story that's on there, and it is related to the announcement by Eric Hovde, the California bank owner and Wisconsin property owner and businessman, that he is going to be running for U.S. Senate. He will formally announce next week. And in doing so, he's going to have to, at some point, defend some past comments he has made about Social Security and Medicare. You might recall a couple of weeks back, we marked the 84th anniversary of a single check placed in a mailbox in Vermont. It was the first Social Security check. It was part of the country's dedication to having workers enjoy a retirement free from destitution, because during the Depression, rural poverty amongst the elderly was heading north of 50%. But now, 84 years after that first Social Security check was delivered to a retired legal secretary, there remains a faction of politicians eager to limit or kill the nation's landmark social insurance program. It's sure to come up as Tammy Baldwin seeks a third term in the U.S. Senate and seeks a stronger program, while this likely opponent contends that Americans should delay their retirement. Hovde has run for Senate in the past. He ran for Senate in 2012. That was the year that Tammy Baldwin was first elected to the U.S. Senate. Recall that she defeated former Governor Tommy Thompson. But what you may have forgotten by now, a dozen years later, is that Tommy Thompson emerged battered and bruised from an extremely divisive three-way primary. And Eric Hovde was one of those other candidates engaged in that nasty primary. We haven't heard much from Hovde since, but 12 years later, he feels ready to run for Senate again. But while he was running in 2012, and it's hard to believe his position has evolved much since, he preferred to refer to Social Security and Medicare as entitlements rather than the earned benefits that Americans pay into throughout their working lives. And he said benefits, quote, absolutely need to be trimmed. He talked last time he ran about putting Social Security benefits further out of reach of many Americans by moving their retirement age. His exact quote in a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel interview went like this: if you're under 50, you're going to add 2 years to the retirement age. If you're under 40, you're going to add two more years. And if you're under 30, you're probably going to have to add another year. Now, it's worth noting the Social Security retirement age today for many Americans is 67, but he would push that to 72 for people who are currently in their 20s. Baldwin, meanwhile, has frequently mentioned her support for strengthening Social Security. For example, right now, the limit on the Social Security tax, the payroll tax, tops out at salaries of $168,000, meaning that you pay a Social Security tax on that first $168,000, and then you don't pay any more Social Security tax after that. So let's say you're making north of $30 million a year, like a whole lot of Hollywood stars, a whole lot of superstar athletes, a whole lot of people on Wall Street and other business executives. You reach the income of $168,000 by like January 3rd, January 4th, and you're done. You're done for the year paying into Social Security while everybody else is paying in for all the rest of the year. And so there's certainly been talk about taking that $168,000 limit and nudging that, shall we say. But Eric Hovde is going to tell you that these are, quote, entitlements. And by the way, we are still on the verge of a government shutdown, about 2 weeks away now, threatened by Republicans who want to continue to see slashes to domestic programs and would like to see what Ron Johnson has always referred to Social Security as, a Ponzi scheme, which tells you how much respect he has for people who've worked their whole lives paying into a program. So this is still something that's very much on the table, very much will be a campaign issue as Tammy Baldwin runs for a third term. Again, no guarantee that she'll be challenged by Eric Hovde, because there's still talk that the former Milwaukee sheriff Clark might get in. There's a Milwaukee area businessman who's also been flirting with the idea of getting in. So, you know, there could be, again, a messy Republican primary in this U.S. Senate race. So more to come on that. In sports, at 6:17, the Milwaukee Bucks have now played 10 games since firing coach Adrian Griffin and luring Doc Rivers out of the broadcast booth, and the Bucks have gone 3-7 under Rivers, losing in Memphis to an understaffed Grizzlies team 113-110. It was the last game before the week-long All-Star break, thank goodness. Maybe the coach can come up with a new plan, because his plan last night involved blaming the players for being focused on the All-Star break rather than the game in front of them. The Bucks' next game is a week from tonight in Minneapolis to take on the Timberwolves. The Badger men's basketball team plays at Iowa tomorrow. You can catch that game on locally grown radio in Wisconsin Rapids, News from the Center in Richland Center, Lake Air at Amory, WRJN in Racine. And the fourth-ranked Marquette men's basketball team, big game tomorrow at UConn, taking their 8-game winning streak against the nation's top-ranked men's college basketball team. The fourth-ranked Badger men's hockey team is at Ohio State this weekend. The second-ranked Badger women's hockey team hosts the Minnesota Gophers this weekend. Wherever you're listening across Wisconsin on this Friday morning, when you're here, you're up north live from Lake Wasota on the Civic Media Radio Network.
On air.
I do like that voice. That's James Ingram, who turns 72 years old today, teaming up with Quincy Jones on that song, 100 Ways. We will have much more in today's history lesson, a rather special edition of our history lesson, now with more history coming up in just a little bit here. And Pam Yonke with the Midwest Farm Report coming up in less than 10 minutes from right now. Coming up on 60 Minutes this weekend, the former chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, Andrew Hitt, is being interviewed by Anderson Cooper. And the 60 Minutes tease notes that Republicans in 7 states, won by Joe Biden back in 2020, cast fake electoral votes for Donald Trump. On Sunday, Anderson Cooper interviews Andrew Hitt, who claims he and his fellow electors from Wisconsin were tricked into signing the documents. Here's an excerpt from that 60 Minutes interview.
Beautiful kids, Andrew. Good, good. I'm going to blame you, Andrew, if they don't do it.
Can you imagine the repercussions on myself, my family, if it was me, Andrew Hitt, who prevented Donald Trump from winning Wisconsin?
You're saying you were scared.
It was not a safe time. If my lawyer is right, and the whole reason Trump loses Wisconsin is because of me, I would be scared to death.
It was not a safe time. He would be scared to death. I mean, seriously, this is a guy talking about Trump like he's, you know, a mob figure. And of course, we then saw what did happen on January 6th. And it should give people, again, pause about Donald Trump. Now, we also want to make note before this 60 Minutes interview that Matt Smith over at WISN-TV rightly notes that Andrew Hittis talked about this before. He talked about it on Upfront, which is the program that WISN distributes all across Wisconsin that you may see on Sunday mornings. And that's also where Hitt talked about being duped by the Trump campaign, which I am a little bit skeptical about. Yes, they talked about it being a legal backstop in case there were issues with the election. But everybody knew there were no issues with the election. So as you could hear in Andrew Hitt's voice, it really was more about intimidation, feeling forced into helping with a scheme rather than some kind of legal backstop, which is what they were originally saying that it was. To what degree should the fake electors be held accountable? Well, they've had to settle a civil lawsuit and have had to promise not to be electors this year in the election and to never be electors anytime Donald Trump is on the ballot. They've had to file paperwork that essentially puts them on record as admitting that they knowingly provided false information in 2020. And yet, one of those fake electors, Bob Spindell, is still a member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and he is there with the blessings of Devin LeMahieu, the Republican leader of the Wisconsin State Senate. So we'll see what else we learn from Andrew Hitt on Sunday on 60 Minutes. All right, this next story is a little bit international, but has a connection to a certain Wisconsin politician. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny should not have been in prison. He at the age of 47, was young and brave and motivated by love of country and concerned about a dictatorship that was ruling his people. And apparently, he is now dead. This morning, Russia's Federal Prison Service said that Navalny felt unwell after a walk on Friday and lost consciousness. Well, gosh, at least he wasn't, you know, had an accident with a skyscraper window or something like that, as has happened to other journalists and opposition leaders in Russia. In December, Navalny was moved to a prison in the Arctic. Why was he in prison? He was not pushing a war of violence. He was not pushing for violence at all. He was trying to work within institutions to allow people to have more of a say in who speaks for them, who represents them, who has power over them, who wants to serve the people rather than rule. Those are the kinds of things that Alexei Navalny and others were fighting for. Navalny had been one of the last remaining Russian opposition politicians who actually posed a serious challenge to, as the New York Times puts it, Putin's monopoly over the country's political landscape. He had built a robust political organization with offices across the country. He drew thousands to his anti-Kremlin rallies. And over the last few years, before he was arrested, the Russian government went to great lengths to try to dismantle the infrastructure he had created. Many of his allies had to flee Russia or get arrested. He'd been doing some time in one Russian prison, but in December, disappeared for 20 days. And when he reemerged, it was then learned that Russian authorities had shipped him off to a prison in the Arctic, where inmates endure long, dark, cold winters and then clouds of mosquitoes in the summertime. It's a successor to a Gulag labor camp that was established for prison workers who were building a railway across the Russian Arctic that was ordered by Stalin back in the day, but never finished in full. The previous prison was only just a little ways east of Moscow, meaning his lawyers could drive there in a matter of hours. And he was able to communicate with the outside world to a degree through his writings and messages. But apparently even that was too much. Even though he was behind bars, that was too much for Vladimir Putin, who had him sent away to this Arctic prison, which, again, in itself would have been harsh for somebody who is nothing more than a peaceful opposition leader. But now he's dead after taking ill while going for a walk. This is the kind of stuff that Donald Trump and Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson talk about admiringly. Strong men who take control. That's not control. That's a dictatorship with a lack of freedom for anyone who isn't part of the ruling class. That's not what America has ever been about and should never be admired publicly, especially by our own elected officials. For those who say, well, he should have known the risks, don't mock his bravery. You have no idea what you would do if you were born in that country instead of this one. Would you sheepishly go through life? Or would you live your life like Navalny and like our founding fathers and those around them who left their homes, fought, and died to give you the ability to decide that you want to vote for Donald Trump, who thinks that Putin and other dictators around the world are great guys? Don't think for a moment that if Trump got into office, there wouldn't be some kind of mysterious or violent episode in the future happening to someone who tries to stand up to him. He's going to test the limits. He's going to test the boundaries. If you don't think that's the case, get your nose in a history book or two, or just a newspaper, and read up on what's happened fairly recently in other countries where people have turned their backs on democracy, thinking a strong man is what we need. Ron Johnson has nothing but faith in Putin, saying the other day he can't lose in Ukraine. Yes, he can. Yesterday marked the 35th anniversary of the last Soviet troops pulling out of Afghanistan. It can be done if our leaders are brave enough to stand up to guys like Putin. Key of Akil is next. You're up north. UK. Time to wrap up the week's worth of headlines, not just in Washington, D.C., but around the country with Courier Newsroom's national political correspondent, Kia Vakil. Kia, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Pat. I'm well. How about yourself?
Very good. Thanks. You know, as I'm looking through the news wires and the things that you are writing, editing, some of our other news outlets in Courier Newsroom are sharing, there was a graphic that stood out to me that I wanted to talk about first. And while former President Donald Trump certainly has a cult of personality around him, when you actually talk about the things he says he wants to do, you understand that he gets disproportionate attention compared to how many people out there in the US of A actually support what he stands for. What kinds of numbers, what kind of a disparity do you see in all of this?
Yeah, so CNN worked with a polling firm recently towards the end of January to survey voters on, you know, some of Trump's most notable proposals and policies and ideas for a second term. And they found that virtually all of them were incredibly unpopular. So this ranges from, you know, Trump potentially pardoning himself. 71% of voters oppose that. Trump pardoning January 6th defendants, 69% oppose that. If Trump were to direct the DOJ to investigate his political rivals, 69% also oppose that. Firing federal workers, 2/3 of voters oppose that. Firing federal workers who oppose him. And then, you know, if he tries to repeal and replace the ACA, Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, which, you know, helps about 40 million Americans get health insurance, 61% oppose that. And there were other ones. You know, his most popular one was an immigration bill, but even that had under 50% support.
Well, I mean, that makes sense since he's never won the popular vote in an election. So, you know, again, if by some chance he gets an electoral college majority this year, well, starting next year, he's going to propose things, but they're not going to sit well with the bulk of Americans. And so when it came to, you know, the despicable statement that he made last week and repeated this week, that he would frankly invite Russia to invade NATO allies, you know, based on their financial contributions to the Atlantic Alliance. It it does make people talk about what is America's place in the world, especially if Donald Trump were to be leading it. I'm struck by that, and also by the fact that there's been really no noteworthy Republican critics of Trump's comments that I can think of off the top of my head. You can comment on either one of them, but those to me were the things that stood out most, and I wonder what you were reading or seeing out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that Trump's remarks on NATO and Russia, come from his more isolationist tendencies. And that's, you know, a throwback to about 100 years ago, pre the World Wars, and what America's foreign policy was then. There's arguments to be made of, you can have a conversation about that, but to suggest that, you know, you're okay with Russia just, you know, running roughshod over current allies of the U.S. Is quite a thing to say. And to have not a single Republican really condemn it, says a lot about where that party has gone. This is a party that traditionally is more interventionist than many Democrats are. It's a party that, you know, until recently was, you know, very anti-Russia. It just says a lot about how much the politics of it have shifted. And that's all because of one man named Donald Trump.
It is, again, just amazing that a party can turn on a dime that way. And especially given his record since he won one election, and Republicans have been losing ever since. And yet they stay with him. There's more Trump support than ever in Congress. There's another government shutdown date looming out there. And yet Congress is home, for most of the next couple of weeks. So really the only big news out of there was that the House Republican majority, already thin, got thinner this week.
Yeah, we saw, your listeners may remember a fellow by the name of George Santos, or Anthony DeVolder, depending on when you came across this man. He was a first-term congressman from New York who was ultimately basically kicked out of the House recently because of, a litany of crimes he committed. He's under federal indictment. So there was a special election to replace him. The Democrat who held the seat prior to Santos, Tom Suozzi, I might be mispronouncing his name, he won the special election quite handily by about 8 points. That shrinks the Republican House majority even further. They can now only afford to lose, I believe, 2 votes on any bill. That's down from a majority that already cost Kevin McCarthy his job. We're seeing Mike Johnson, who's the new House Speaker, unable to do virtually anything. Every single day, there's new reports about another Republican retiring. And these aren't like old 80-year-old Republicans. These are people who lead committees. These are people who are quote unquote up and comers. People are just fleeing because the House Republican caucus is such a nightmare and so impossible to work with that anyone who with common sense is just leaving. This is not a party fit to govern.
Well, you think of them, opposing the border bill they demanded, and yet then having the audacity to impeach the Homeland Security Secretary. So that heads over to the Senate, and everybody who remembers Donald Trump's 2 impeachments knows that in many cases, the next step is for the Senate to hold a trial. Do we think there's even going to be a trial in the Senate on this?
No, Democrats control the Senate. This is such a political hatchet job that there's no reason for them to hold a trial. It's Chuck Schumer's decision and it's not going to happen. The only version where I could see even considering it is if you want to try to get Senate Republicans on the record. But I'm not really sure. I don't anticipate that happening, especially given there's a government shutdown coming and it's an election year. All of this just speaks to how much House Republicans are, really just kowtowing to Donald Trump and trying to really appeal to their far right base, who's really anti-immigration. Mayorkas has become sort of the latest boogeyman to them. And, we've had several Republicans say, they find it to be uncomfortable to impeach him. They think there's no basis for it. There's no evidence. There's, it's a really bad precedent. And yet you still saw virtually every Republican vote to impeach him.
Yes, you did. Let's look at some of the state-by-state news that we're following at our Courier Newsroom sister outlets. And I want to start in Pennsylvania simply to show another example of something happening in a state where you have, you know, Republicans who have at times been in charge of the legislature while a Democrat is the governor. We had an instance like that in North Carolina talking about Medicaid expansion. But we're going to talk about Pennsylvania today, because mm-hmm. if you think it's odd that Republican legislators here in Wisconsin have been essentially sitting on a $7 billion surplus, wait till you hear what's going on in Pennsylvania and what the governor there has to say about it.
Yeah. So in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro is the governor. He's a Democrat, and the state house is controlled by Democrats. But the state Senate is controlled by Republicans. So they have to negotiate. Pennsylvania has a $14 billion budget surplus. And, you know, the governor Shapiro wants to use it to make environmental repairs to public school buildings. You know, a lot of them are aging. They have, you know, environmental exposure issues, you know, they're in sort of crumbling state of some schools. So he wants to spend some of that money to address that. He wants to invest more in public transportation funding. We're seeing a lot of, you know, public transit agencies dealing with some shortfalls in the wake of the pandemic. Yeah, and he just wants to make reforms to universities and community colleges to sort of streamline the process and improve them. But, you know, we're seeing Republicans, you know, oppose a lot of those things. And so, you know, they're going to have to negotiate and we'll see what happens. But, you know, it's not a great sign that they're obstructing.
Yeah. And I would say, and I don't know that anybody there has said it out loud as has been done in Wisconsin, but, you know, their thought is, well, if the surplus just sits there, you know, it gives us a chance whenever we do get back in power to then yep. just give it all away in the forms of, you know, tax cuts geared toward the very wealthy. And that's it's a heck of a way to run a railroad. But that's why. So when we hear about this, you know, near mountain of money that Wisconsin lawmakers are just letting sit there and not invest in the people, it's twice as big there in Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, over in Iowa, again, we had that terrible mass shooting just south of them in Kansas City. And yet Iowa Republicans are just the latest to say, well, you know, more guns. That should be the thing that helps. And in this case, in schools.
Yeah, in schools. There is legislation in Iowa, which is a Republican-dominated state, both at the legislature and then the governor's office, that would, the bill would allow basically teachers to be armed and bring their own personal firearm to school. And the identities of people who are armed at school, teachers, would be concealed under this legislation. It would allow these staffers to undergo training. And they would be issued, you know, a permit. But this, it's just mind-boggling. I'm trying to imagine being a parent and having like a 7-year-old child in an Iowa classroom with a teacher armed with, you know, a weapon. And that's mm-hmm. utterly terrifying.
Well, it isn't. And part of the reason as well, and God knows I'm not casting aspersions on teachers, but I'm saying anytime there is a gun involved, part of the reason that there is this campaign to reduce gun suicides, for example, mm-hmm. is that people who are otherwise responsible owners have a moment of crisis where they snap would be, you know, the an inelegant way of putting it. And who's to say what happens, not just if a kid gets hold of a weapon, but if a teacher or a coworker, you know, has that kind of access nearby. There is nothing about this that is helpful. And yet this is, again, the talking point that we see, that somehow more guns are going to make things better. The only thing that seems to about as ridiculous, and we don't have to dwell on it, but we'll end our tour around the country in Arizona, where Republican legislators are getting a track record for throwing people out of committee hearings just because they don't like what they have to say. I mean, say what you will about a lot of, you know, legislative bodies. At least it's not like that. That sounds downright authoritarian.
Yeah. I mean, Arizona Republicans are maybe even have one-upped Wisconsin Republicans in terms of anti-democratic behavior. We've seen at the national level or at the statewide level over the last 3 or 4 election cycles, they have just lost and lost and lost because they're increasingly, you know, out of touch with most Arizonans. At the legislative level, they still have narrow majorities, but you know that could change this year. And part of the reason is because they are increasingly arch conservatives, and so they're ejecting, you know, citizens and advocacy, you know, directors of advocacy groups for speaking. You know, generally when bills are introduced or advanced in legislators, people can come and speak out in opposition or in support of them. Sometimes ordinary people come, sometimes advocacy representatives come. And so they have ejected multiple people because they spoke out in opposition to legislation, Republican introduced legislation. They ejected a reporter because they did not like the question the reporter asked. And, you know, this is very much on brand for party that tried to overturn representatives of that party tried to overturn the 2020 election in Arizona. And it's just, you know, they're totally committed to the only, you know, people who buy into what they're selling.
Yeah. I mean, if you can't handle a civil debate with somebody opposed to you, then, mm-hmm. you know, again, it's hard to see why you should be even trusted to run any part of government. But that's what's happening in some parts of the country. And Kiev Akil brings this to us every Friday from all the various newsrooms from Courier Newsroom around the country. Kiev, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
You too, Pat. Thanks.
All right. And a reminder also from Courier Newsroom, the Vibes Only podcast. It's a new podcast with Brian Derrick and Glenys Mahar. The new edition is out where they talk to Dan Pfeiffer, former senior Obama advisor, to talk through some of the vibes of the week, how to talk about Biden's record versus his age and much more. Look for Vibes Only where you get your podcasts. All right. Kind of a special history lesson today. With extra history thrown in about the Billboard charts, where we talk about so many musical memories. That's coming up next. You're up north.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
One 106 years ago today, this day in 1918, Patty Andrews, the lead singer of the Andrews Sisters, was born in Mound, Minnesota. Birthdays today include LeVar Burton, host of Reading Rainbow, Star Trek The Next Generation, Roots, LeVar Burton 67 today. Tracy Merrow, better known as Ice-T, is 66 years old today, and actress Elizabeth Olsen is 35. Also, happy birthday to Abel Tesfaye. You'd know him better as the singer known as The Weeknd. On this day in 1974, Bob Dylan got his first number one album with Planet Waves. We played a little of James Ingram earlier, 72 today. He was born in Akron, Ohio. On this day in 1957, the number one song was by teenage heartthrob Tab Hunter. I was looking at the video of him singing this on a TV show with, you know, the background singers behind him kind of looking like the Jordanaires, you know, behind Elvis. They're all dressed up in their full suits, but he's singing about young love, and you could see him kind of basically rolling his eyes and kind of smirking. And it wasn't until his 2005 memoir that he could reveal the frustrations of being a gay man forced to go through the charade of dating all these Hollywood starlets like Debbie Reynolds and Natalie Wood, because that's what the Hollywood studios demanded of him. All right, now we're going to do a little Billboard history here. And it all started with noting that it was on this day in 2011 that Lady Gaga hit number one with a song. Well, let's hear a clip of the song. It was Born This Way, and then we'll tell you about its place in history. All right, so this song was the 1,000th number one song in the history of the Billboard Hot 100 charts. 1,000 number one hits. Well, that sent me down the Wikipedia rabbit hole yesterday, because I've always had this fascination with the Billboard charts as a certified radio rat. That's where I thought I was always going to work. I wasn't a DJ very much or very long, but I enjoyed it very much. I was one of those kids, and I know there were quite a few of us of a certain generation who would listen to Casey Kasem, and we'd write down in a notebook, we'd write down all 40 songs of the top 40, you know, and track what they were doing. We did. This is what we
did.
That's
awesome. I love it.
We'd play radio station with our Panasonic cassette recorders. So, you know, the Billboard charts, I'm familiar with these.
Yeah.
So where did this 1,000 number one songs come from? Well, I did not appreciate this. Billboard and their charts date back to 1913, when they had a chart of the 10 best sellers of popular songs of sheet music. Because there wasn't radio or records or jukeboxes or anything like that back then. So they had, it started with a chart in 1913 of popular sheet music sales. Then they created top charts of the songs performed on theater stages and then in the movies. The record charts didn't start until 1936. Then there got to be multiple types of charts. In the summer of 1940, they merged all those charts into just a popularity chart that combined sheet music, radio plays, jukebox plays, and record sales. And on that particular chart in 1940, here was the first number one song. It was Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra with a young Frank Sinatra singing along.
Within my heart, I know.
Yeah, that's what number one music sounded like in 1940. Well, then the lists splintered again into various types. But then in 1958, they were reformed into an all-genre singles chart known as the Hot 100. And it's been the industry standard ever since. The first number one hit on the Hot 100 in 1958 was by Ricky Nelson.
Poor little fool. Oh yeah. I was a fool.
So that was number one hit, number one. Lady Gaga had number 1,000 in 2011, which of course begged the question for me, where are we now? How many number one songs on the Hot 100 chart have there been? And as of last week's chart, Megan Thee Stallion had the 1,163rd number one hit with a song called Hiss. And you know, normally when I say a title and an artist and I pause, that's when Greg hits the button and plays it. So when you hear me go, Megan Thee Stallion had a number one hit with Hiss, and I pause, you're not going to hear any music, because Greg, I tried to play the clean version of it, but it sounds so missing because I can't play a single line. No, definitely not Ricky Nelson. I can't play a single line of the clean version of that song on the radio. It is just F word, N word, S word, B word, P word, F word, N word, S word, B word, P word. That's the song by Megan Thee Stallion, the current number one song on the charts. I'm sorry, I can't play it.
I found something I can play here. Here we go.
That's pretty much it. Again,
there we go. Megan Thee Stallion, everybody.
You can find the clean version, but it sounds like you like a CD and you dropped it, because It's all the time just, you know, going silent with all the words. So instead, our final song of our history segment, I'm going to retreat back to 1965 and play number one hit number 142, because we have one more birthday to note. The late Sonny Bono was born on this day in 1935. He passed away in a skiing accident in 1998. But from 1965, here he is, Sonny and Cher, and a hit on Sonny's birthday. Roger, of course, knows we played this on Groundhog Day.
Well,
Put your booties on, kids, because it's cold outside.
That's right. And let's see. Kit says good morning from Washington, D.C. Thank you. Appreciate you. Yeah. Appreciate you listening as well. All right, on this national calendar, it's a rather short one today. It is the first Friday of Lent, so it is Fish Fry Friday. It is also National Tartar Sauce Day, National Almond Day,